following podcast is an exclusive presentation of Project Entertainment Network.
Hello, is anybody out there? Anybody, this is Jim Cobb. If you're hearing this, the worst has happened. I've recorded a podcast at the end of the world and will broadcast it on channel PEN every Friday. It's all about the apocalypse, books, movies, TV, how much food and water will you need your bunker, all that kind of stuff.
Excuse me, sir. You're going to have to keep the noise down. You're in a library and you're scaring the kids. The world hasn't ended yet.
Sorry, ma'am.
Shh, you're in the library at the end of the world with host Jim Cobb.
Fridays, exclusively on Project Entertainment Network.
This is full-scale war against the terrible enemy that modern man has never forfeited.
And if ever you do not realize you are in an interstellar conveyance, you are already outside the atmosphere of your own planet.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack. Celebrate, it is number 200. And we have brought back in action, we're going to have him for a while here, I think we got him chained to the bedpost here. Mark Maddox is with us to celebrate number 200. Can you believe this, Mark? We're already at number 200.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Jim Adams tearing through podcasts the way, I don't know, something tears through something else.
Yeah.
That's impressive, man. I mean, You ought to be proud of yourself. Nobody else is, but, you know.
Yeah, I know. That's
you
right.
You ought to be proud of yourself. No, but, I mean, it's
you know,
200
wild.
Episodes. Yeah. Holy mackerel.
All these movies that we saw growing up. I mean, all of these movies growing. It's hard to believe how many there were.
Yeah, I know. And we're still finding new ones that we haven't seen. And you will let me know about a film that I need to watch and vice versa.
Yeah.
And that's just proof that there's probably going to be hundreds of more episodes of this show. So
yeah, sort of like that with this, because I recommended this movie to you that we're going to talk about this week and you'd never seen it. And actually, this is one that we have seen quite a bit.
You are funny.
I am funny.
No, you are funny. Yeah. This one is, We you know, of course, we weren't going to do one of our episodes where we sink our fangs into something.
Right.
And, you know, we said this before, even with the ones that we sink our teeth into or make fun of them or whatever, we still watch them again and again. So it isn't like, well, except for Creeping Terror.
Yeah.
But, but Dracula versus Frankenstein or the slime people or whatever, they will be rewatched by us. So that has to say something about the fact there's something we still like or love about them. But
yeah, absolutely.
Every once in a while, you know, we have to get serious and put on a film that we consider to be anywhere from good to great to an absolute classic. And I think today's is an absolute classic.
I do too.
It's at the height of the Universal monster craze, just right after. As a matter of fact, this is from 1932.
Yep.
You want to go ahead and give the introduction?
And we're talking about The Mummy, the original Mummy. It has been copied a few times, I should say many times, but this one still, I think, stands up above just about every one that's been made.
It's different from a lot of mummy movies in the fact that this is not about a berserk walking down the middle of the street at 2 a.m. ready to strangle somebody kind of mummy, which has been done again and again.
Yeah.
This is more of a sophisticated, I know exactly what I'm doing, evil kind of this is a smart mummy.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
what this is. This is it's different. And it's kind of strange because I think a lot of people have either seen images of mummies from monster movies or watched television. Hell, they even did one on Amazing Stories that was an absolute hoot, you know,
that's
about
right.
a mummy, a
yep.
comedy one.
Yeah.
There's Hammer's The Mummy. There's the later mummy films that Universal did, the more B-style pictures that they did
with
Tyler and then Lon Chaney Jr. This one is different. So if you see this one second or third or fourth or fifth, you're kind of taken aback by the fact that there isn't really a rambling mummy in this one. There isn't a on the attack sort of strangulating mummy. This guy's different.
And it's a love story. When you think about it, it's a gothic love story. It really is. Well, I mean, that comes into it more than anything else in a very bizarre way, but it is sort of a love story.
Well, my question is about it is it's been the idea of a guy who has spanned oceans. I mean, I'm even thinking of Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula.
Yeah.
The Bram Stoker's Dracula. When this movie has the I've been dead for 3,700 years and you are now with us and you are reincarnate. You are the woman that I loved from 3,700 years ago, but it's your spirit and you're in the body of a now living, breathing person, a reincarnation. Is this the first time that was done or has it been done before? It probably been done in literature and stuff like that, but you know, if not, that's, you know, a pretty inventive, you know, it's pretty,
Yeah, for film, I think this was probably pretty much the first time this kind of subject was dealt with. Yeah, I think you're right.
I mean, somebody's going to tell us we're wrong. I should call somebody up like Tom Weaver or Jonathan Rigby or somebody and go, hey, look, was there a pre this film? Was there? And they go, yeah, you're stupid. And we go, okay, yeah. Jim Adams is stupid too, by the way.
I'm going to quantify this a little bit. As far as when I was growing up and watching the different Universal films as they were being displayed on Monster Movie Matinee and the other shows that I watched that had monster movies on them, this is the first time I saw a subject like this presented. So for me, it was a first.
Yeah.
I'm sort of glad that I saw this movie before I saw the others. And again, you know, folks know I've already reviewed two of the Mummy films. I've done The Mummy's Hand and The Mummy's Tomb. And of course, in a very loving way, because I loved all of those four Mummy movies that came several years after this one. But this one was so unique. There are so many visual images, and it's a thinking man's film, I think. You know, it's an intense film.
I think I saw this film first. Now, it's been so many years. There was a whole, like I told you, back for me coming to the United States in 1969, back from my dad being in the Air Force, seeing all these monster movies hitting me within the first 2 years of being back. I believe I saw The Mummy at that time. And I got to admit, I hate doing it, but it's the truth. I think I remember being slightly disappointed that you only see anything of The Mummy at the very beginning of the film. You only see that stereotypical mummy movie. But as the years have gone on, it's reversed, done a complete 180, and I like this better.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a more thoughtful film. It's a more mature film. And I still love, you know, a lot of those other mummy movies as well. But this one to me is really my favorite. And we can go right in. You know, I mean, it starts off with these guys in 1921, and they're working for the Archaeological Society in the United States, and they're digging up stuff, and they're waiting to look inside this mummy sarcophagus. They've opened it up and they're looking at him, but they're not going to go over him just yet because they've got to do everything in order. So there also too is this box with something that they don't know what it is, but they go look at it. It's got this terrible curse on it. If you open this up, man, your ass is grass.
Yeah.
Kind of a thing. So the two leads, one of them, Edward Van Sloan, and I forget the name of the other actor. He's pretty good. He plays basically the father of the later leading man in the film. But
yeah, that's Arthur Byron.
Arthur Byron. Yeah. And they're both him and Edward Van Sloan. Edward Van Sloan from Dracula.
Right.
The year before, they're there looking at it. It's like, and Edward Van Sloan does his usual, no, you should not touch this thing, you know, kind of. And they, which sounds more like Bela Lugosi than Edward Van Sloan, but
there's some similarities.
I mean,
you could see the influence of Dracula, which came out the year before, on this film. It's very similar.
Oh yes.
The way the story is presented.
There is. So, yes.
Yeah, there's a lot of
yes,
fun things.
Yes,
that you
absolutely
can relate.
The only thing that's a little bit more and Karloff is a scumbag. The Karloff mummy in this movie is a scumbag.
Yeah,
he really is. But at least unlike Dracula, who's just a prick, Karloff's mummy has a reason for doing what he's doing that you could sit there and go, from his messed up point of view, I get why he's doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
The problem is he's killing people in order to do it.
Yeah, he's obsessed with this princess who he ended up being executed because of his love when she died of a disease, and he trying to raise her from the dead, and then the gruesome way that he was killed, and you know, his spirit continued living on
wrapped
is up part of the curse. Oh, I know. That's one scene in this movie I never forgot as a kid. I mean, that scene,
yeah,
the flashback
Karloff's
scene.
Face being wrapped
up. Oh, my God, that was great. Yeah.
And Karloff, the eyes sticking out from under the under the wrappings as they're wrapping him, knowing he's already suffocating in there. So we come upon a scene which is really one of the most famous scenes in horror films. The two guys are outside discussing the do's and don'ts of opening this box. And this young assistant who I remember seeing him as a little kid and thinking, oh, that was – if it isn't Dwight Frye, it's a good – it's a, you know – but this guy was good. You'll have to tell me the name of the actor, but he deserves some kudos.
Yeah.
And he's there and he's, okay, I'm not supposed to touch the box and I won't and everything. But he keeps on looking back over. They do this long extended scene of him trying to get back to work and then looking at the box and trying to get back to work. And finally he just goes to hell with it. And he goes over and he opens the box up, which, by the way, it's weird – on this new restoration that Universal put out a few years ago, the box is semi-transparent. You can actually see things lifting out of the box and everything, which I thought was nice.
Yeah, yeah.
It shows you what a fantastic job they did on the restoration. But he reads from this thing and you know, looks at the scroll and starts going over it, and the mummy behind him comes to life. Now, it's still the single best image of a mummy I've ever seen. It's really dirty. He's covered with dirt and grit and sand. And all the other ones, you know, there's a lot of other great mummy makeups, but this one here is the best. It's
absolutely
Jack Pierce full on, Karloff full on. I mean, and you only see him for a second, and then
that's
you
it.
See the hand reach in while the guy's trying to read it and take the scroll, and it drives the man insane. As a matter of fact, you find out later he died laughing in a straitjacket, but that scene of him being driven mad by seeing this thing alive is pretty powerful stuff, and it works in every respect, you know, and him saying silly stuff like he went for a walk.
Yeah, that's another one of those scenes that as a kid I never forgot, because – thinking of all the different ways you could play that, and this was just done so realistically, I think. I mean, you know, the actor's name, by the way, is Bramwell Fletcher, is the guy who played Ralph.
Oh,
Martin.
Yeah. Okay.
And, you know, when he slowly, you know, you get that feeling that someone's watching you, and you could see that on his face. I mean, all the facial expressions on this guy are great. As he slowly turns because he realizes someone else is standing next to him and looks up and, you don't expect to see a dead mummy staring at you. And just all he gives is a, ha!
Yeah.
That's it. I mean, I just want that one, ha!
Yeah, and then he just,
and then he just starts, and then the laughter, but it builds, starts very slow. And as we see the bandages or whatever sort of trailing off. I mean, we don't see the mummy, but you know what's dragging behind. I think that is one of the most incredibly effective scenes in this whole film. I just, that whole sequence is brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
I'm almost thinking that over the years you wanted to see more images, you know, of Karloff in that makeup. And you see pictures of him in the studio chair or Jack Pierce working on him on a, when he's like kind of half tilted on a bar stool chair so that, you know, the makeup doesn't get in the chair and whatever, you know, it's him working. That's where you see most of the pictures of the mummy, and also shots of the mummy with his eyes closed, which is kind of unusual because even on like Monster magazine covers, the eyes are closed a lot of times because that's the images they had to paint from.
Yeah.
But you look at that scene, and I almost think later if they had shown the full mummy walking out of the sarcophagus and then doing it, I don't think it would have worked as well.
No, it wouldn't have. It wouldn't have.
Given the fact that nowadays we can see everything. Nowadays we've got special effects that could show every minutia. And back then, Jack Pierce's makeup was incredible.
Yeah,
it would be fun to see it, but it also would hurt it because that nasty, scraggly hand with that little boogery looking thing on there's like a hair with like a some chunk on the front as his hand goes to reach for the scroll, and that's all we see. Every time I see that, I go, ew, just somebody break that off. It's just nasty looking. You know what I mean? You know what I'm talking
that's
about.
Right.
And I mean, even in a VHS copy that's been reduped four times, you can still see that boogery thing on the front of his finger, and it's like you've got to respect them for having the nerve to have Jack Pierce put that much work into that makeup, and the director still says no, because you know it looked good.
Yeah.
There was nothing like that. I mean, it's you know, this isn't hiding it because it's the monster only. This isn't Jaws where they don't show Bruce that much because he isn't working well. But they did it for a director's reason, and it works. And the next time you see Karloff, it's like 11 years later. Yeah. David Manners is the son of the head archaeologist from. Archaeologist from 11 years earlier who refuses to come back out there because of what happened to that guy. Yes. He stays in United States or Cairo or whatever. Anyway, so David Manners is there, and who shows up to the new dig or to this is Karloff comes walking in. He comes in, he's Ardeth Bay, and he goes, "I am Ardeth Bay." Now that imitation was a little better than the terrible Edward Van Sloan I had done earlier.
A little bit.
But the makeup, it's weird. This is where, for mummy movie fans or mummy movie, what you expect, this is where it's different. We have a walking, talking human being. He's wearing a fez, is that right? A fez is the red hat. Yep. He's got long robes and he's talking but his face is not as wrinkled as it was when he was a full-on mummy. It's like he somehow, over the last 11 years, has managed to sort of suppress the full-blown look. Now, whether it's through hypnotism or whether he's able to revert himself I don't know what he's doing.
They never explain it, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. You figure it's something having to do with magic or whatever.
Think back when Ralph goes mad, he's reading the Scroll of Thoth, which is the scroll that they buried with Imhotep so that nobody else would get a hold of this power. That's what he was using to try to raise the princess from death. Essentially that's what I think what they were trying to say was that's what Ralph did. Reading the scroll raised him from the dead. So whatever magical powers went with that also allowed his heart to keep beating. Now, for folks that are thinking of the other four films, which again, I think we got to talk about them just briefly because so many people lump all these together. That they started a whole new tradition of keeping the mummy alive through Tana leaves. That doesn't play in this one. They're not using that. Yeah. That here is strictly this scroll.
Completely
different. Yeah, the Scroll of Thoth.
Is not even part of the same.
No, it's not even the same story.
Yeah, this is not a series.
Right.
This is not. You don't even that Universal did a reboot.
A total reboot
is what those later mummy movies are. Yeah. And that's why you can kind of single this one out and it isn't like, oh, you guys dropped the ball. No, they didn't. They just did a different
thing. That's right.
It's a
different story.
Other than the fact that those are like B pictures in comparison, even though this movie does not have a lot of, you know, giganticness. It doesn't, it not a lot of globetrotting in it and everything like that. It's still, I think at the time this was considered an A picture.
Oh, absolutely.
There's people that hate horror films.
No, it was.
Call them B pictures. But so Karloff kind of comes in and he's like, you know, talking to him. And he looks weird and old and everything like that. But he goes, I can tell you where there's a great find for you guys to get. And he points him to this place, burial area of this, ancient princess, Ankh Sennamon. And so the next thing you see, we're at the darn Cairo Museum where they were, where they took all this stuff, all the stuff they found, from the burial site. And what do we got? We got Karloff standing over the stuff all the time, looming over it and everything like that. And it's kind of like, what's this guy got going on here? So you got Karloff and he's there at the darn museum and he's looking over all the artifacts, which by the way, you know, mummies in real life at that time, digging them up and bringing them and stuff was really big.
I believe most people that are familiar with this movie know how influenced it was from the discovery of King Tut's tomb. Because in the beginning of this film, you know, when you're talking about when the father was over there on the archaeological digging stuff, it took place in 1921. Wow, exactly the same year that they discovered King Tut's tomb and then the curse that went along with it and all that. So that had a big factor in this film. And Egypt stuff, even 1932, you know, it's sort of fascinating. I'm going to go off on a little tangent here just for a second. Egypt was so popular during this time period, during this decade, that a lot of major theaters, big movie houses and stuff, decorated in an Egypt type genre. If you go to some of these old palace style theaters, they have that Egyptian look to them and stuff. So it really
Fox Theater in Atlanta. Absolutely. Got some of that. The Fox Theater. All of that,
Middle Eastern stuff and Egyptian stuff. It had a huge impact. And what I think one of the reasons this film is such a big success, because people love this stuff and love the mystery and the intrigue that came out of the discovery of King Tut's tomb. So anyway, little side note, but just to set the table for what's to come.
No, but I mean, it's important. It's part of the culture. It was in the culture at the time. It was in the forefront. And then the films follow suit. I mean, that happens a lot. So you've got this guy, you know, and he's sitting there saying this girl's name. So we go across town. This is one part that does give me a little chuckle, where it looks like the photograph of Cairo is on a wheel and it spins real quick. And then you go to this party across town, and Zita Johann, the lead in the film, the lead actress in the film, is there, and during this time, all of a sudden, she starts feeling really weird and all this kind of stuff, and is sort of hypnotized or something
under
the spell. And we're switching back and forth between Karloff in the they've closed up the museum at night, but he's in there with the darn candle and the scroll, and he's calling her name, and she kind of gets hypnotized and just goes walking towards the exit, and then and gets in a vehicle and goes there. And just as David Manners and his dad are leaving the locked up museum, she shows up and tries to get in and passes out and all this kind of stuff, and they take her back to the house. It's when you start to understand that there's a whole thing, a connectivity between this person that Karloff is calling for and this woman living in the modern age.
Right, Helen, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's the part that I think was different. Now, we've said how much, and I believe it is very similar in some ways, but it does not hurt the film. People go, well, this is just a remake of Dracula. I don't think so. I think it's in the same timbre, the same tone as Dracula. Yeah. I think it's, once again, you've got a Dracula-esque sort of a villain, but still not. Karloff is, you know, like we say, he's got a different agenda here.
Yes.
David Manners is in it again. And by the way, I want to say something about David Manners. There is a world of difference a year makes. I love him in the 31 Dracula, but he is already warmed up in his acting skills the very next year in The Mummy. He's already ready to go and do The Black Cat 2 years
later.
He's very personable. Yeah. He does a great job. Edward Van Sloan does a great job and stuff too. Everybody does. And so people say, well, it's a remake of Dracula. No, it's another thing like, hey, Dracula was a success. What are we going to do next? Okay, here's The Mummy. I still think this is right up there with Dracula.
I think there's a reason people make that analogy or that association. And that has to do with the director, because we'll talk just a second about Carl Freund, because he's the guy that was behind the camera for Dracula. He was a very well-known cinematographer, a genius when it came to shooting. I mean, he's the reason that Dracula looks so good as it does. And you see that here in The Mummy, too. Just the beautiful look of these films can be owed a lot to Carl Freund. And one thing about him, and this is the tech side of me or the filmmaker side of me, Carl Freund is the guy who started the process of moving cameras. You know, if you look at films in the 20s and the 30s, it was always a static shot, just one shot. Then they would have to lift the camera up and move it.
Right.
But he came up with techniques almost like, well, the closest thing you could do to handheld back then, because these cameras were huge, but, you know, putting them on a rail and stuff. And you see some of that in both of those films. So I think there's a similarity between the two, like, the zoom, the moving shot into Dracula's casket in Dracula, and then what he does with the sarcophagus in this film and some of the moving shots playing up into The Mummy here, they're very, very similar. So I think that's where a lot of people, the storytelling is similar between the two, but the look of the film is very, the two films is very similar because of the work that Carl Freund did on this.
He did the scene even when we were talking about earlier with the guy going, being driven mad by seeing the mummy. There's pans in that scene.
Absolutely.
Going back and forth across that room and stuff. And I'm like, at the time, that would have had to have been considered real dynamic. Now,
absolutely.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Wasn't Carl Freund the head of photography on later on the I Love Lucy?
Yes, he was.
Wasn't that his name in the credits?
That's him. He's also the one that came up and developed the three-camera technique that all of these sitcoms started using back with I Love Lucy. And he also made sure that Lucy was shot on film and not using a television camera. That's why it's lasted so long in syndication.
Oh, yeah.
That's why it looks so good
because
of that.
God knows very I love innovative. The Honeymooners, but if you look at the Honeymooners, yeah, it's yeah. kinescope, and it's yeah. like it doesn't look. I mean, I Love Lucy looks like little movies.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Because of it. They look like little films, and that's why the show could be – that's one of the reasons it stayed such a massive success into the 60s, 70s and stuff, because you could – because the picture looks so
beautiful.
Good.
Beautiful, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It wasn't like you were, you know, going back to the old days. But so, you know, we've got this scene with – You can tell where this is starting to go is that the Zita Johann character is, you know, fragile and all kind of stuff. She is, she's two people.
Yep.
There's a person from the past and there's a person in the present who loves David Manners and now, of course, David Manners' dad is freaking out because he's starting to figure it out.
He's putting it together.
Karloff is after this woman, this curse or whatever is going to get at, because, when they bring her back to their house, she's speaking Egyptian terms that are ancient,
right,
and the guy's like, uh-oh, is this part of that curse business? And then the son starts falling in love with her almost immediately, and he goes, oh, boy, here we go. and then Karloff shows up to talk to him. Oh, well, what happens, too, is that a guard who catches Karloff gets murdered, and Karloff accidentally leaves the scroll.
Right.
Well,
right.
So you've got Edward Van Sloan, you got David Manners and his dad, and they're there and they're piecing things together. And Karloff shows up, and first off, he's like completely enamored with this woman.
Yes.
But then when he finds out that she was actually the person outside the museum trying to get in, he's like, oh boy. And she's digging it. That's the difference. She's interested in this wrinkly old dude,
yeah.
even despite there she's being pulled towards him, and it's like, holy crap. And David Manners, so you can see where this is going. It's going to be a duel between fight between David Manners' modern woman and this ancient princess from Karloff's time. So what happens is that they don't waste time. With Dracula, it's almost like you kind of are guessing, or the people in this parlor drama are, well, what's wrong? There's nothing wrong with Dracula. He's weird, but blah, blah, blah. But they don't waste any time. In this one, it's like, hey, we've got this scroll, and Karloff finally admits, he goes, that's my scroll,
yeah,
and all that kind of stuff. And then he immediately starts to whip out a curse, and Edward Van Sloan's like ready for it.
Yeah.
And so unlike Dracula, which you really don't get until the last like 15 minutes. I mean, you're halfway through this film and you know Karloff, you know, I mean, he's an ancient ass kicker.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's going to, you know, and he's come to whip.
That's right. That's right.
So this goes back and forth. And what we find out later is the full thing. And I think you've said part of it is that we find out that, you know, he was in love with this woman. She got sick. She died. He tried to do what he could to bring her back to life. The rulers of Egypt were like, no way. What you did was wrong and all that kind of stuff. So they bury him alive and they don't take his guts out. Like they said, I think he said his ephemera is still intact.
That's right.
When they were looking at the mummy.
Yeah.
So he was buried alive and everything like that. And then was revived when the young man, when the scientist in present day
with the scroll,
you know, said this stuff. So he wants to basically bring Zita
back to life,
to who she really was.
Yeah.
And what it's going to take is they got to mummify her.
Yes.
there's a scene even where she like comes there one time and they did. By the way, there's a great shot. You talked about the camera moving.
Yeah,
now I'm going to tell you something. There's a shot in here that's worthy of 1980s, 70s, 80s ILM Star Wars, yeah, Indiana Jones, where he starts to explain something to her. By the way, the dad is immediately told by when Karloff leaves after first trying to whip out a curse, he is told to burn the scroll.
Yes, that's right.
That Karloff needs.
Yeah.
Well, he goes to burn it. They leave, you know, which was stupid. The guy, all the guys separate,
yeah,
and the dad goes into his office by himself. Well, Karloff goes back to his place and uses this this pool of water almost like a TV, a two-way thing, and can project curses through it, and gives the dad a heart attack. It's a pretty bizarre scene. I mean, Karloff is got his arm over the pool, and he's really going for it, and the dad's clutching his chest while he's trying to burn this scroll. Well, he doesn't.
Yeah.
And then what we found out too is that Karloff is in control of their servant in the house.
Yes.
This is Nubian. Supposed to be a black guy. I think Noble Johnson.
Noble Johnson.
Yeah, I mean, I think Noble Johnson, wasn't he a white?
Yeah.
He was in real life.
They used makeup to make him look Nubian. Yeah.
Right. And so he goes in and he burns some newspaper and then takes the real scroll. Right. Yeah. But and then you find out later. I mean, of course, Edward Van Sloan realizes later that the scroll wasn't burned. But anyway. There's a scene where he's explaining to her back at the same pool that he uses to wipe people out from a distance. The camera is behind him and goes up and over their heads and then down into the pool. And then this thing of smoke comes out of it. And I'm like, boy, that's
really good.
I mean, and then it separates. And then there's a picture and I'm like, dang, how the hell did they do that back then? But it's brilliant.
It is. Oh, it's a
really,
wonderful
It's
shot.
Really a yeah. really well done special effect. Yes. And that's when we find out that they were lovers way back and 3,700 years ago when she died. And then he did the bad deed of trying to bring her back. And then he gets mummified alive and blah, 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 and everything. So that's what this film basically turns into, is her going back and forth between being this princess and being this, modern person, living in today. And as you get closer to the end of the film, it really becomes a struggle with her, to the point where, Karloff tries to kill David Manners by the same way, by remote control television. No, not remote control, but he tries to kill him from long distance.
Right.
But luckily, Edward Van Sloan had given him a charm that he luckily clutched onto at the last second, and it saved his life. And then they wake him up, and then he goes, oh, man, he took Zita back to the museum with the big Egyptian setup,
and
he's going to turn her into a living mummy like himself. So they hightail it over there. Now, she's already been converted over in terms of her costume. She has now been redressed in this Egyptian stuff and telling her who he is and all this kind of stuff. And then she's like, let's do this, until she starts to realize, oh, you got to boil me in oil, or you got to cut my guts out. Is it about that time? looking at a watch that's not on her wrist. I think I hear, can we go get something to eat first? And it gets worse. And then finally, he literally gets her down to the table, is going to start cutting her guts out, and they show up right at that moment. There's enough of her left. There's a great moment when he puts his hand on her to try to subdue her a little bit. And then when his hand is removed, it's like it's got dirt. Dirt. Like he's still kind of falling apart in a way.
Yeah.
And she really, that's the thing, when she goes, no, I've decided I want to be alive. I want to live.
And there's a part of the ancient princess still in her that I think is opposed to it too. I think that, because it is blasphemous.
Yeah. Yeah. Because,
she's fighting it
dirt.
As well.
Yeah. 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 But she said, she goes, what was the god that she said that she goes, you're not supposed to be dealing with
Osiris,
that, like it's black magic.
Isis.
And something like that. Yeah. She goes, and so she's like sitting there going, look, dude, I'm not into this. I'm not into your retirement package. That's basically, She starts to freak out, and she even tries to, get the Nubian. He's going to kill her. Yeah. And she's like begging him. And then you can tell the guy is thinking about what I'm doing is wrong.
Right. Right.
And then Karloff uses his magic ring and kind of backs the guy out of him. He's kind of out of the picture then.
Yeah.
So luckily the guys come racing in right as he's getting ready to cut her guts out of her and put them in the little jars or whatever they do.
Yeah.
And then she jumps up. And she kind of knows what to do. She goes back to her gods and starts praying to them. And they kind of, there's a big statue up there and all that. And they kind of pronounce judgment on Karloff, and they zap him, and he's just like nothing but a skeleton at the end.
Yeah.
You know,
and they burn the
destroys him,
and they burn the scroll.
Yeah. Yeah. They did it. And at the end, you see David Manners with her calling her back to present day.
Right.
And all that. And it's one thing about old monster movies. They kind of ended real quick. I mean, oh, yeah, it's like yeah. kind of like the way the ending of the movie. What's the movie? This is going to be way into the modern era. The ending of Death Proof, the Quentin Tarantino film, where it, like they beat up the last punch in Kurt Russell's face, and the movie's over. You know, I mean, it's sort of like sometimes people, younger people, are sometimes kind of shocked the way a film will just kind of end. There's no two more minutes of of, you know, pontificating and everything.
Yeah.
But, you know, movies ended. You know, the problem's over, problem solved, boom, the end. But now when this god, the statue or whatever, its arm actually moves and it's sort of like a bolt of lightning. They don't show it, but you hear it.
Yeah.
You see Karloff sort of age back into the mummy briefly that he was at the beginning of the film. I watched it again, you know, this morning, and I was like, boy, that's just a great special effect. There's a skull inside it. It almost makes me wonder if they made him cut it real short before you saw a full skeleton face.
Yeah.
But, you know, the makeup was superb. I mean, it was great. And anyway, so
only one thing about the film when I read and studied about this film that I sort of regret. One of the decisions they made, and that's, we're going back to the big pool that Imhotep or Ardeth Bey used. He could sort of see things, and where he was showing Helen their story, you know, about what happened. And they had filmed some more scenes with Zita Johann that showed her reincarnated over the centuries. Like she was, she was a Christian being thrown to the lions during Roman times, and she was in the Saxons, in a Saxon war and things of that nature. And there were like four or five different scenes of showing where he was showing Helen, this is who you were over the centuries, and now you're this person. You know, you've been reincarnated every time. And they cut it out, and Carl Freund decided to cut it because he thought it was going to take too much time and slow the movie down. But I wonder if that would have been so cool if they could have kept that in there. And unfortunately, the footage is gone. You can find still photographs from the scenes, right? You know, when they shot them, but the actual footage, they don't know whatever happened to it. It's gone. And it's a shame. I would have loved to have seen the film restored with those in there just to see how the film plays. I don't know if it would have hurt it or not. It's hard to say.
I don't think it would have hurt it. This is not the fastest paced movie in the history of mankind. Some people say, boy, I've heard critics say it's really slow. I've heard other people say it's wonderful. To me, the movie plays just fine at the speed it's at. It fits in with the first Dracula film. Yep. With Dracula's daughter and with a Werewolf of London, and that they're kind of like those parlor mysteries or whatever. I call them parlor horror films. I mean, they sort of like take place on a stage type setting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're shot like stage shows.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to see it, but you know just as well as I do. I mean, footage, old footage like that, when it's gone, when they've edited it out on purpose and it really was not the director's wish for it to be in there, chances of finding something from that far back
it's gone,
being intact, it's like it's gone.
Yep.
That was burned, you know, which, you know, it was a shame, or at least even to see a bad copy of it in the extras of the on the Blu-ray or something would have been nice to see. But and I think that's interesting too, because even I had that question when I was watching the film. Did he just happen to be woken up at the right time for this woman to be reincarnated right at this right time, or did his being woken up kick off her, you know, coming back? You know, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
and it sounds like the film answered it. Like, she kept being reincarnated. It's almost like you're playing the record until somebody lifts the needle.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
You put it on.
She's been
put on a loop through the centuries.
Right.
That's
the impression I got, was that, you know, so it took him 10 years to find her. They woke him up in 1921. Now we're up to 1932 or 1931 or whatever you wanted, about 10 years later. And it's taken him that long to find her counterpart in the United States.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I had that question before you ever told me about that footage. That was It was, it wasn't a big question. It wasn't like, you guys ruined the movie, or it wasn't like that, but it was like,
sure.
It was like, oh, how did that work? How did that work? I mean, I guess in a way it's, it's metaphysical. It's,
sure.
It's magic.
Sure.
It's whatever you want to call it. And so the timing worked out.
Yeah.
But the other thing was a good explanation too. My question is, with her going through the ages, how long did it last? If it lasted more than a minute or two, once you got the explanation, you didn't need to see it. It's sort of
they gave you some other things along the way. I mean, the fact that, we can mention that her character, that Helen Grosvenor was half Egyptian. She is in Egypt when we first meet her. Her mother was Egyptian, but her father was, I think, British or American. So there's all sorts of little tie-ins that maybe she does have a link back to this somehow, that it's more than just coincidence that she just happens to be here at this time, that he is brought back as well. And that this, I don't know, like you said, would have, she was going to continue being reincarnated. Now, I get the impression from this film that once she called on the goddess the last time, to strike him down and burn the scroll and stuff, that's it. She's done. I don't think she's going to be reincarnated anymore after that. That's where I don't know the philosophy that they were dealing with. I guess you'd have to ask Zita Johann, because apparently she was very into this stuff. She was a believer of reincarnation personally, and into paranormal and occult type studies that she used to use in teaching acting and stuff. So she was the perfect person to play the role, that's for sure.
You know, the thing is that I kind of got the feeling that, I mean, reincarnation might just be reincarnation, whether you got somebody waiting to wake you back up or not.
That's true.
I mean, Jim Adams could be reincarnated from some ancient Egyptian dude or something. I mean, it's sort of like that in a way. So in this case, Karloff was able to go after maybe every single person in the universe of that film could potentially be reincarnated from other people.
Yeah,
I mean, there's people that believe that.
Oh,
In her case, he was able to zero in. He called to her, and the person who was reincarnated from her showed up at the museum. Even he wasn't sure. It wasn't like she had a neon sign above her going,
oh no, that's right. No, that's right. Yeah, you're right.
And so even he was surprised. Remember, he's like, oh, okay. So my, online dating service thing worked.
until she mentioned she was the one who was trying to get into the museum and passed out. Then he realized that's her. That's it. We found her.
He was interested in her already, but then when she said that, it was a done deal.
That was the kicker.
And I don't know. I mean, I never, ever, ever, this is going back to the visuals in the film, I never get tired of certain things in the film. One is the sets.
Yeah.
They're not gigantic or anything, but they're nice.
Oh, yeah.
All the stuff I'm sure the studio guys made. Karloff's makeup is just so damn good in this. It is so, it's really amazing. I want to know, if I probably watch the extras, and I've watched them before, listened to the commentary and stuff, but it's been several years. I wonder if they shot all of his stuff as fast as they could, like, okay, let's do all of Karloff because of that makeup job. You know what I mean? Because it seems like that would be so tough.
It was
to go,
it was
okay,
pretty
what
rough.
Days are we making there,
I saw an interview with his daughter where she was talking about how painful that was for him, not only to wear, but to have it removed. And I mean, it was hours and hours and hours to put it on, hours to take it off, just for the short period of time that it's actually used in the film. So it was, kudos to Karloff to go through all that.
Maybe that's another reason too. That first mummy costume is just unbelievably good. And then you get in, move into this more human, back to human sort of makeup, but it's still incredible. I mean, you've got artists that paint and draw from images of of him doing that, you know, I mean, and I've done it myself, I think once or twice for once for a DVD cover. There was, I did a portrait of him from it. And you look at the makeup and you can go, well, that's not as mummy like as some of the stuff. It still looks like it's a hell of a lot of work.
Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it still looks, I mean, for those wrinkles and ripples and everything yep. in his skin to show up on a 1930 film, you know, and you could see it even when you were watching it on your local station from a 16 millimeter print was 40 years old.
Yeah.
Still amazing how good that looks. And then he's got the ring and he's got with the scarab on it. He's got the darn knife. There's that fez that he's wearing and that long robe. And then the way he acts. I mean, Karloff is very menacing in this movie. There's movies like you look at him as the Frankenstein monster where there's moments where you really truly feel sorry for that monster. There's only a few moments in the film at all, if any, that you feel sorry for him in this film. He's a real scumbag.
No, he is.
In a lot of ways.
He's
got
evil.
A reason for it.
He's evil in this movie. Absolutely. Yeah, there's no doubt.
Yeah, I can actually see how somebody, you know, you're in a coffin for 3,700 years. I could see how you could probably come out, you know, a little messed up. But you know, and you could almost look at him and go, hey, look, if you hadn't killed all those people before that, maybe we could still sympathize with you, but you obviously feel it's totally okay to kill. I mean, how many night watchmen did he take out in this movie?
I know quite a few.
You know,
yeah.
You're sort of like, and he gave the guy a heart attack. He felt like he was totally justified. And that's easily a tipping point. You're like, hey, you know, I can kind of sympathize with the guy. Nah, not anymore, buddy. You've done proven yourself to be rotten, but
that's right.
Anyway. So yeah. I mean, you know, this is a classic. It's one of the, you know, great Universal monster movies. Therefore, you know, it's part of the gold standard.
That's it.
And 1932, I highly recommend watching the restored version where they take literally about 10 years off of its life.
Yeah.
It looks so much better now. After it's been restored than it did originally. And,
That's
you know,
right.
DVD copies, they look fine. But that Blu-ray now that they've got out of it is just so nice to watch. So it's better in every respect. So
it's a winner. Thumbs up all the way.
I think we like it.
Oh, absolutely. This is a classic. And I think it's one of those 50 years from now, people are still going to be watching this film and talking about it and just marveling it. Yeah, what a good movie it was. One of Universal's best during this golden age. And a very good selection for our 200th. So we seem to always go back to Universal for these milestone episodes. 100th was Son of Frankenstein, and this time The Mummy.
Yeah, I think sometime you can do a great Hammer film or something too.
Oh, yeah.
Or
absolutely.
Maybe even something like Metropolis or Nosferatu or Cabinet of Dr. Caligari for another anniversary episode. There are other places to pull from, but Universal is just such easy pickings. It's
it is.
Oh, what are we going to do? Well, let's go look through the Universal.
Right.
You know, I mean, I'm surprised that it was all the way to 200th episode to do this film. I'm glad, because when you told me we were doing a 200th episode and I said to you, what hadn't you done yet? You said The Mummy. I'm like, oh, man, I'm there.
Yep.
Yes, absolutely.
I've been saving it.
So,
this one I've been saving.
Yeah, great,
hopefully, I know there's more movies out there.
Well, I appreciate you having me on.
Oh, absolutely,
this.
Man.
I really do. Thank you so much.
You were here for the first. You were here for the 100th, and you were here for the 200th. So it all fits into a nice,
now get lost.
Nice format. Now get the hell out of here. No. Oh, jeez.
Yeah, well, cool.
Check them out, folks. Yeah, I mean, you can get all of these episodes on the archives up at the Project Entertainment Network site, projectentertainmentnetwork.com, and all 200 episodes are up there in the archives, so check them all out.
So where you literally have every episode is up there.
Every episode.
That's
from,
great.
From the preview, starting from the preview going all the way up to episode number 200. Check us out Monday at 5 o'clock on the Project Entertainment Network. Have a great week, folks. We'll see you then.
May I have your attention for the morning announcements? Please be advised the Lunch Ladies Book Club is coming to Project Entertainment Network. Join Shelley, Mimsy, and Ashley as they dish out a deep review of a book. Horror. Thrillers. Whatever they want to read and review. A blonde, a brunette, and a redhead walk into a bookstore and they're serving up hot book reviews. The Lunch Ladies Book Club, coming soon, exclusively on Project Entertainment Network. Would you now stand for the national anthem?
Don't get your lunch money stolen!
This has been an exclusive presentation of the Project Entertainment Network.